Hello, friends. I'm Patrick Barney, one of the hosts of the Book Spider podcast, a program that examines novels and a smattering of other mediums in fine critical detail. We pride ourselves on our rigor, theoretical acumen, and astute insights. With me, as always, on this intellectual journey are my colleagues, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. We all have master's degrees in writing, literature, or both. So you can trust us to treat our subject matter with due seriousness and weight. On today's episode, we're going to be examining two novels, Paul Auster's Timbuktu and Olaf Stapledon's Sirius. The connection between these two works is that both feature dog protagonists, but each approaches its hero in very different ways. Timbuktu, which would probably be considered more of a literary work, explores the life of Mr. Bones as he witnesses the decline and death of his owner, Willie G. Christmas. From then on, Mr. Bones must fend for himself, leading to encounters with a loving Chinese boy who is disallowed from having a dog by his father, and to a suburban family who finally take him in. However, Mr. Bones finds it difficult to adjust to this idyllic place, and when the family decides to leave him in a kennel when they go on vacation, disaster strikes. Sick and out of his mind, Mr. Bones escapes the kennel, wanders through the wilderness for a bit, and then decides to play one final game to see how many times he can cross the highway without getting hit. Sirius, on the other hand, is more of a genre novel, specifically science fiction. This novel features the title character, Sirius, as he tries to deal with the fact that he is entirely alone in the world. A big, handsome Alsatian, Sirius is the product of a scientist's attempts to create a breed of superdogs, more intelligent than normal and better able to serve humanity. However, Sirius develops into more than just a superdog, becoming smarter than the average person. He learns English, though he can't speak it properly, dabbles in music, poetry, essay writing, and a slew of other human projects, and forms a very tight, perhaps romantic bond with Plaxi, the daughter of the scientist who created him, Thomas Trelone. Throughout Sirius's life, he endeavors to rise above his dog-like nature and is constantly aware that his intelligence puts him in an untenable position. He is neither true dog nor human being, which condemns him to solitude. He loves Plaxi, but cannot have anything but a familial relationship with her. Nor can he have a relationship with a female of his kind, since to him they are all dumb brutes, incapable of higher sentiments. Eventually, the people of the small township he lives in take note of his intelligence, attributing it to evil magic, and he is ostracized. This leads to a confrontation between Sirius and a local farmer, who tries to kill him. Sirius defends himself, killing the farmer instead. Sirius then goes into hiding as he and Plaxi plan his escape. However, before they can put their plan into motion, the townspeople hunt Sirius down and shoot him. As usual, once we've discussed Timbuktu and Sirius in detail, we'll make some connections to the previous podcast episode in which we examined Split Tooth by Tanya Tagak. So, I think we'll just start with a general question. What are the differences between Timbuktu and Sirius in terms of technique, narrative viewpoint, and so on? What effect do these differences have on our reactions to the novels?
I was going to say both take advantage of the fact that they have an outsider perspective on humanity for human to have Sirius and Mr. Bones comment on humans and the things that are, you know, make us interesting or silly or impressive. Sirius is impressed by human hands, but very disappointed in our own lack of appreciation for how powerful they can make us. Mr. Bones is loving of his owner, William G. Christmas, but also very, very kind of, I guess, like broadly compassionate to the aspects of his humanity that make him a drunk homeless person, and in a way that I think is like a little bit accepting of just, you know, broader human foibles. Yeah, that's a similarity. I mean, they're very different in that I think Sirius is very, I think, like attempting to make broad political, sociological, philosophical, sort of speculation on, you know, on being alive, on being a human, on being sentient. Whereas Mr. Bones and Timbuktu, that didn't really feel, I didn't sense a cohesive philosophical thread through it. That really coalesces into anything that, that's like a message or meaningful in the way that it does with Sirius.
Yeah, I think sorry, go ahead, Petring.
I just wanted to make a note that I do want to talk about what you think the message of Sirius is. But go ahead, Hans. We'll talk about that in a second or two.
Yeah. I guess one difference, too, is that, you know, because Sirius comes out of what I guess what you would basically call a science fiction tradition, Sirius seems much more concerned with, it's concerned with kind of establishing, I don't want to say verisimilitude exactly, right? But in the point of Sirius is that it is strange and notable that this dog has a fully developed sentience and can talk and think, right? And a lot of thought is given to the details of how that's achieved and how that kind of exists in the world and what the kind of specific boundaries are of how Sirius can function. Whereas Timbuktu, I think, is it's I don't know. I mean, we can have probably a conversation about what's real and what's unreal in Timbuktu, but like it's just kind of taken as a given within the world of the novel that this particular dog understands what people say and has something approaching a human level of consciousness. And I mean, I think if anything, probably actually it's maybe a bit in some places to the detriment of Timbuktu, because, you know, the question of what Mr. Bones does and doesn't understand or what he can and can't interpret or it becomes kind of muddy in places.
Right. Yeah, you know? Definitely.
So I think there's a certain kind of, like, because it's funny, actually, I just to kind of tip my hand here, I definitely was much more appreciative of Sirius than Timbuktu. And it's interesting.
Oh,
because,
really?
That's interesting. Yeah. And in general, I'm much more somebody who reads, I'm much more inclined toward literary than genre fiction. I don't read a lot of sci-fi, particularly not from the era that Sirius was written in, but I.
Right. Yeah. The 40s.
Yeah, exactly.
The golden age of sci-fi.
I'm not sure I've read any golden age sci-fi, actually.
Got some of the best stuff as far as I'm concerned. But
it
anyway,
might very
on.
Well be. Yeah, yeah. And it's not, I don't have any, you know, I don't have any great bias against it. It's just not something I've happened to encounter.
Right.
But I mean, the kind of the rigor with which Sirius had to treat its premise because of its particular kind of genre context, I thought actually ended up being a strength over some of the looseness of how Timbuktu treated similar premise.
Interesting.
Right? Because there's a lot of time I spent in Timbuktu kind of questioning the nature of the kind of just basic framework of the structure of the world and the character that I you know, Sirius was just not sloppy in the same way.
Right, that's true, definitely.
Now, it might be, I mean, there are certain, you know, critiques that I would make, and I don't want to get into them right now, but like, if Timbuktu were better in other ways, I might have not been as worried about that stuff, you know? I mean, that's the kind of concern that happens when you're not distracted by enjoying a thing, but anyway.
Okay. So, one other thing, and it kind of speaks to, I think it speaks to what you see as a failing in the novel, Hans. One other difference between the two novels is that Sirius is actually told not from Sirius's point of view, but from an outsider's perspective. Plaxi's husband to be. I'm drawing a blank on his name, Robert. But he actually starts the narration of the novel in first person and then recounts the story of Sirius. Whereas in Timbuktu, the viewpoint is third person limited to Mr. Bones, right? Is that a correct assessment? Okay. And so that also creates, like, I would say that seems to be what's responsible for the sloppiness that you're talking about, Hans. The fact that, Mr. Bones, seems to be more aware than any normal dog would be, but still seems to get into the same kind of trouble that a normal dog would because of ignorance. That to me seems to at least partly contribute to this sloppiness that you're talking about.
Yeah, and a lot of it, I think, just had to do with what I characterize as sloppiness. I think a lot of it had to do with uncertainty about, I don't know, like, any time that there was a question about whether or not he understood a particular word, like, he knows that English is a language, but he's able to figure out just from observation that English is a language, but he's not able to figure out from observation what a vacation is, right? Like, he's like, oh, right. I've heard the word vacation, but I don't understand what vacation is. And it just didn't, again, like, if I'd been more engaged with the character in the story, I might have just let it by the, you know, ignored it. But there was something very odd about the idea that, you know, a dog could figure out contextually what English was, but could not figure out contextually what vacation meant.
Right.
It's just all very, it just all feels very arbitrary, right? And I think, this stuff is, I think, partly important because, like, one of the narrative drivers, like, one of the key drivers of the events is whether or not Mr. Bones understands, what is happening in the world and whether or not he can intelligently assess what to do in a given situation. Right. It matters because that understanding or lack thereof is really kind of like one of the basic plot mechanisms. And so when there's sloppiness and inconsistency and arbitrariness around that, it just becomes very irritating. Right. Or like, go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, I mean, like, I think the example, the thing that sticks out for me is when he's fixed, right? And it's interesting. I think that this is an interesting, like, tack to talk about, like Auster's craft even, and kind of like what I see as the opportunities maybe to write this story a bit differently, paying attention to different things and having different things emerge as like generators of conflict and challenge. And in my mind, be a little bit more interesting too. And just sort of jumping into when he's fixed, he wakes up and he notices that his testicles are gone. And it's very interesting that the book, like the narrative sort of jumps outside of his awareness of what that means to as a kind of a bridge to talking about like the different you had a question that you sent us earlier about sex, and it's like this is the opportunity to talk to about Mr. Bones's sex life and how he's not aware that like he's not aware of the puppies that he has produced, and he's not aware right. of the what the loss of it was just a very ungainly thing to kind of explain what Mr. Bones is not aware of, because he's not aware of the puppies that he's created, nor is he aware that having no testicles means that he's not going to create puppies in the future. And it was just really odd. Right. It was such a strange thing.
Right. And now, is it, we wouldn't think it was odd if the narrator had shown previous examples of like full omniscience, right? I'm assuming that if the narrator is totally omniscient, we're fine with this. But because he's not, we have a problem.
Well, I think that it's odd because it's more, I feel like this story is more interesting if like there are, if we're more trapped in like the limits of Mr. Bones, and if those limits are more consistent. And it's not necessarily because obviously you know, like there's a sequence in here where Mr. Bones literally dreams the future. So like there's a kind of a bleed there, you know, Mr. Bones and or the narrator have much more awareness than, you know, is normal to a dog or an individual right. mortal being. But it is, I think it's just sort of, it's sort of interesting to take us out of the experience of just having woken up being like being operated on to this conceptual space having woken up being operated on, being in pain, having like a portion of your body gone. You know, there's like there's a kind of a physical experience of that that is like, I think, very interesting. And then there's a conceptual exploration of it that isn't. and that's where I was really struck by this, by Timbuktu. I was sort of wondering what Paul Auster was trying to do.
And I'm going to bring this up because I think it gets back into the question that I think we're kind of still working on, right? Which was technique and narrative viewpoint, right? Right. You had mentioned, Chris, the dream sequence where Mr. Bones dreams the future in immaculate detail. And I think one of your questions, Patrick, actually was, what's up with that, right?
Yeah.
And I think pretty clearly what's up with that is Paul Auster thinks that he should show that scene because either he likes having it in the novel or he believes it's narratively important. And he's just looking for any, you know, method by which to show that scene, right? The dog can't literally
Where Willie dies.
Yeah, he wants to show Willie's death scene, and the dog can't literally be in the hospital.
Right.
So, you know, the dog dreams in precise detail the exact thing that is going to happen, right? And so there's, I mean, and maybe I'm being unduly cynical, but it feels like a lot of the like, this novel feels like it was written in a very intuitive way without giving much thought to, like, internal consistency or just kind of whether things made sense. And I guess on some level, like, because of the nature of the premise, you do have to kind of be intuitive about what feels good and what feels bad, right? Because, you know, you can't really apply any kind of normal verisimilitude to it. You just have to kind of follow the dictates of what just kind of subconsciously feels like the right thing. But like, there's just kind of a level of like, that technique just to me felt so much like just kind of shrugging and doing whatever was necessary to have the scene in the novel.
Sure.
That it killed a lot of credibility, and I think was one of the things that just kind of made me begin irritably questioning a lot of, you know, I mentioned sloppiness earlier, right? And the technique of the dog dreams the future was one of the kinds of sloppinesses of technique that really kind of made me irritably begin just kind of trying to push all the, you know, push on all the joints and see what gave, you know.
Kind of chiming into, I think you mentioned the rigor of serious Hans. And I think that that's definitely like evident in all of the, you know, details that, you know, sort of guide the plot. And it's, you know, it's more plot driven, but it does feel like the work that it has to do to kind of explain why things are going in the direction that it's, that they're going, and why these characters, why this intelligent dog would do these things, that sort of stands in contrast to Timbuktu. And something about both novels that I noticed, it felt like neither was really trying to, and maybe for a good reason, really trying to be like, you know, this is a dog's perspective, this is how a dog sees the world. Timbuktu, it feels a bit like we're occupying, you know, a very anthropomorphized, you know, dog perspective, but not like a dog perspective. And that's maybe harder to excuse when it's we're not really receiving that story through a human. And going back to your point, Patrick, Robert is telling the story of Sirius and is really doing a lot of interpretive work. We're not really invited into that. But it struck me partway through Sirius where I was sort of kind of wondering if this is really like a, you know, like a dog's perspective. But then I realized like it isn't. It's a human's perspective of a dog's story. And so that there's a weird kind of layer that sort of protects it from that same like critical angle. And it also, I think, I just want to get this in there because I do want to say it, like Sirius gets to a point where Robert, Sirius, and Plaxi are all like kind of living together. That was genuinely interesting. That was like genuinely like, oh my God, this is really, really like cool. Like this is like,
yeah.
I was, you know, I liked other parts of it, of the novel, you know, a lot, you know, fine. And some of it, not as much as others, but really when it got to that point, I thought like, oh, this is actually like a genuinely like really striking space that we found ourselves in. And that was, I just wanted to put that there. And I understood how we got there and the work that it had done getting us there. And I don't think the novel is very invested in exploring the things that I found very fascinating about that. It's maybe just interested in other things, but the work that it had done to get us there really substantiated that time. And those scenes that story of the three of them in a kind of a love triangle that kind of wish was its own novel. Really, really struck by that. And you know, kudos to Stapleton finding that space.
Yeah, I definitely agree that like the love triangle aspect is one of the most striking features of Sirius, and just the clear like in romantic love that Sirius has for Plaxi, that is frustrated because, you know, he's a fucking dog, right? So I definitely think that was an interesting, striking feature of Sirius. And I think it's good to bring up my second question, which is maybe a little hoity-toity, but what I'm kind of driving at with this second question is the driver behind this second question is something that did in fact disappoint me about Timbuktu, and that is I read the synopsis. It's about a dog getting over the death of his master. So I'm like, this sounds fun. Or maybe not fun, but sounds like it could be really good. And then I start to listen to it, and it's not told from the perspective of a dog. You know, Mr. Bones is essentially like a human he just has a dog's body, right? He, like, maybe he's like a child, right? Like an 8-year-old or 10-year-old child who doesn't grasp everything, but like is mostly a human being, right? As far as character goes. And that kind of disappointed me. I was like, I was hoping that Oster would like really try to represent the character as like a dog, like, you know, and, you know, and Sirius is again shielded from that question because he, you know, it's built into the story that he has a human like intelligence. So we don't need to think of him only as a dog. He's more like an adult person in a dog's body that, you know, we can imagine him doing certain things because he does have a dog's body. And then on the other hand, we can imagine him doing other things because he has a human-like intelligence. And I was, so with the second question I had about like imagining you could be a bat, I'm wondering, you know, why do we think specifically Oster chose to, you know, employ essentially a human character in place of a dog? Is it simply because it would be impossible to tell a story like trying to accurately represent the psyche of a dog? Because, you know, as Thomas Nagel says, you can't really imagine what it's like to be a non-human sentience or a non-human mind.
I think he achieves kind of a worst of both worlds effect in that regard, actually, right? Like,
okay.
Because,
this
you know,
is so funny. I did not think you guys would dislike this. But like,
I don't know if Chris dislikes it or not. I was not a fan, but.
But
when
hearing
I say
what
worst
you guys
of both
say
worlds,
about it, I totally understand. Go on.
Yeah, yeah. When I say worst of both worlds, so it's established, to my understanding, it's established pretty early on that Sirius, what's his name, Willie Christmas? Sirius's dying master has two things that he wants to see happen, right?
Mr. Bones' dying master.
Mr. Bones, yeah, sorry. I was worried
Willie
I would
G.
do that.
Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah, Willie G. Christmas, Mr. Bones' dying master in Timbuktu, has two things that need to happen, right? Mr. Bones needs to find a new family, and his poems and stories in the locker in the train station need to be found by a publisher who will understand that he was a genius and make him immortal in literature, right? And those two needs are established, I think, probably 20% of the way through the novel. And I thought, oh, this is a really interesting setup. This dog is going to find himself a new family and save his master's writing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the question of saving the master's writing is just completely abandoned. And the question
right.
of finding new family, the way that he does that is he just runs around at random until he encounters people, right?
Right.
And either the people take him in or they don't. So it's like I think like where the benefit to your question of why was he not written more like a real dog? I think if he were written more like a real dog, it would be very difficult to have him behave as a protagonist, right? Because
sure.
dogs don't have generally agency and will toward a particular goal beyond a very, very short kind of narrow framework, right? So it seemed at the beginning like he was writing Mr. Bones more like a, you know, childlike person so that Mr. Bones would have at least enough of a, you know, kind of capacity as a protagonist to actually achieve the goals that were set at the beginning. And then in practice, one of the goals is ignored and the other goal is achieved essentially through chance and then completely undermined in the end, right? So it's like, it is actually authentically dog-like of him to solve problems by running until he finds a kind boy.
Right.
But it's like my assumption for the first half of the novel was that Oster was you know, using that more human-like narrative kind of perspective for the character as a way of allowing him to behave more like a protagonist, but then any advantages to that were lost.
I think too, it seems like, and this kind of goes into why Bones, Mr. Bones dreams his dream, and we're you know, allowed to follow Willie G. Christmas. I feel like Mr. Bones needs to have an intellect and consciousness capable of sort of kindly evaluating Willie G. Christmas, right? There's like this, there's a sort of a, not kindly is the wrong word, but compassionately,
right,
evaluating Willie G. Christmas's existence, which is otherwise empty. And, you know, there's a kind of intent there that I feel maybe is also the reason I can imagine finding a voice like that, that is sort of like, you know, if my dog were wise, my dog would understand me, you know, warts and all, and still love me. And maybe my dog is really wise and is sort of even like a little bit eloquent or erudite in sort of criticizing me, but still kind of loves me anyway. And I feel like I could find that voice writing something like this. But then, as Hans says, it's an odd thing where Mr. Bones is put in a situation with the Chinese boy where he understands, you know, that this can never work out, but then the Chinese and he's about to run away, but then he, you know, but then the Chinese boy gets him a hamburger, and his doggy nature and his loyalty make it impossible for him to leave. And there's this weird tension there between like his human-like consciousness and his doggy instincts that doesn't feel like it is entirely like, it doesn't come together. It just sort of is at odds with itself. But I think just sort of putting myself in Oster's shoes, I think I find a voice like this after I find a character like Willie G. Christmas, and I want to tell a story about that character that is from that particular sort of compassionate but critical angle, and like that's where the dog's, you know, particular like voice comes from, his intelligence or just a thought for how I could see it coming together.
This is I'm going to say the fourth novel, either the fourth or the fifth novel of Paul Auster's that I've read, and they tend to either be very, very good or embarrassingly bad.
which one is this?
Well, clearly you don't like it, so embarrassingly bad.
I read New York Trilogy, Book of Illusions, and one more that I have on my shelf. I can't remember the title of, and I thought they were all fantastic. And then I read Sunset Park and this, and they were both bad, almost bizarrely so, right? And it's led me to suspect that he's someone who writes very intuitively and is very resistant either to editing or to showing a draft to his buds and saying, hey guys, what do you think? Now that's all, you know, baseless speculation, but yeah, maybe his bud is a dog. But yeah, I mean, my experience with him as a reader really makes him seem to me like someone who is an excellent artist who is unusually incapable either of self-evaluation or allowing others to evaluate. Although Sunset Park had a bunch of adoring laudatory quotes on the back, so maybe I'm just personally full of shit. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm gonna go ahead and resist, like, embarrassingly bad. The modifier embarrassingly. I totally agree with what you guys are saying, and the more that you talk about it, the more I see the novel's faults. I'm gonna resist embarrassingly though, because I think at least Willie G. Christmas is a fantastic character, and Mr. Bones, if he's lopsided, is at least endearing in some ways.
Sure.
Or does, you know, this is, you disagree with this as well?
No, I thought Mr. Bones was endearing. Mr. Bones and Willie Christmas, I think, were both endearing characters. And part of my frustration probably came from, like, the setup in the first quarter of the novel is... The setup in the first quarter of the novel is endearing, and I did like that, and then it just feels like from there the setup is treated in a I was really disappointed with what felt to me like kind of sloppiness and lack of rigor and
right.
And basically just that there's a setup in the beginning which then deteriorates into the character pretty much just running around randomly and major goals and threads being ignored and forgotten.
Sure, sure.
And those things, you know, I'm not at all someone who insists on everything I read having a tidy narrative and the initial goals being met through effort of the protagonist, right? I know it might even be a bit out of character for me to be criticizing it on those grounds, but I didn't really feel like any other purpose or benefit or attribute stepped in to replace the failure to carry out the established, what was established in the beginning. So embarrassing
right.
That is mean.
So
I liked it. I liked it okay.
Well,
I didn't hate it. I liked moments a lot. I liked Willie G. Christmas, and I really liked, I think Hans said, like, the first quarter and Willie G. Christmas's hallucination or revelation with Santa Claus. I really liked the moments where with the family that I'm tripping over this now, I'm getting them confused. Mr. Bones finds himself with at the end. I liked, you know, those moments where, like, Mr. Bones feels like a smart dog, but he feels like a smart dog. Like, there were moments there that, like, really kind of stuck out where his, you know, like, ignorance comes forward and they're a little bit, they conflict a little bit with, like, how, like, kind of wry and savvy his voice is in the beginning.
Right.
And I think that that's, you know, part of, like, what makes this sort of uneven. But then I liked both of those things. They didn't seem to kind of come together. So I liked the
right.
experience of the book more than I like, you know, sort of thinking about it as a whole after finishing.
Sure, 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 sure. That makes sense. So you just brought up ignorance, Chris. So that speaks to one of my questions. So let's think about that. What role do ignorance and intelligence play in Timbuktu and Sirius? Like, just as an example, so it seems like Sirius's death at the end of Sirius can be contributed, like, in general, to his superior intelligence. You know, just because it causes a rift between himself and, you know, the townsfolk, and that ultimately leads to him being hunted down and killed. Whereas Mr. Bones's death seems more like it comes about from ignorance. Now, we've already discussed that Mr. Bones is an uneven character. Like, in some ways, he seems too aware, more aware than he should be. And in other places, like, when he does seem to have a normal dog's level of intelligence, it's kind of frustrating because earlier he had more than that. But leaving that issue aside, you know, his death can be attributed to, like, he doesn't like the vet, Mr. Burnside. He thinks that Mr. Burnside's a quack or whatever. He doesn't like the kennel, but he's ignorant of the fact that, like, he's deeply sick and that Mr. Burnside needs to help him. So he escapes, he wanders around, he's delirious, and then he plays dodge the car, which presumably ends up getting him killed. Would you say that ignorance and intelligence are interesting motifs in these novels? Like, is there more to say? Does it relate to the message of Sirius that Chris alluded to earlier? What do we think?
Well, I think the motif of intelligence in Sirius is interesting. I mean, and I think in Sirius, it's primarily intelligence, not so much ignorance, right? Sirius is really not in any way an ignorant character. I mean, I think that, you know, Sirius's downfall, I suppose, what is Sirius's downfall? My sense when I came away from Sirius was that it's ultimately kind of a Frankenstein narrative, right? The misunderstood creatures persecuted by the ignorant provincial villagers.
Mm, sure.
And that leads to his, you know, sad, noble death. And maybe that's an oversimplification. I don't know. But I mean, I think that I suppose the easy spin on that is that, like, Sirius's intelligence and understanding set him apart. And it is actually the ignorance and stupidity of the humans that leads to his downfall, right? Mm. And maybe, I don't know if there's even anything interesting to say about that. Maybe that's kind of obvious.
It's just that's the way it is.
Well, and it feels a bit tropey, right?
Right.
And I liked Sirius pretty well, generally. I thought he was I did think he was a very appealing character, and I really enjoyed a lot of that novel. And the ways that they did explore the question of, you know, what would it be like to have a dog's experiences with a human level of intelligence, I thought were pretty well handled.
Right.
The kind of Frankenstein, the way that it ended with the Frankenstein trope, you know, the ignorant villager trope, seemed to me like maybe not the most rewarding way to carry things out. And maybe not. I can imagine a version of this novel that just, you know, didn't happen to employ that trope that would have been more interesting. But I also recognize why you could regard that as satisfying or poignant or narratively dramatically appropriate.
I think I view it as more like dramatically appropriate or narratively appropriate, though it is a trope, right? Like, and it's not, like, he doesn't employ it in a way that, like, is particularly original, but I definitely feel that it caps off the narrative in a way that makes sense, like, as far as verisimilitude is concerned. So I can't fault it on that level at the very least.
Yeah, it just felt good enough. And
right.
It didn't,
yeah.
It just wasn't nearly as interesting and creative as most of the rest of the novel, right? But that being said, I agree with you that it can't really be, like, strongly criticized or faulted, and it's as reasonable as any way to, first of all, I mean, to, you know, kind of create some dramatic poignance, and also probably to, you know, end the thing in 200 pages, right? Like,
right.
If it weren't for the Frankenstein trope kind of bringing conflict that could end in the death of the protagonist, then this might have been a much longer novel.
Right. Like, if he escapes to Scotland with Plaxi, like, do we just have to keep telling the story? Like, we don't...
Yeah, or...
Yeah, because we don't...
Or if he
don't...
actually does become an acclaimed composer, right?
Right.
Like, I would
right,
love
right.
to read a novel about the life of a super intelligent dog composer.
Right? Yeah, that like, would be... That'd
sings
be kind
in
of
microtones, right? Like, that'd be great.
Right.
In a kind of ongoing polyamorous relationship with... You know,
right.
Plaxi right. and Robert. It'd be amazing.
Yeah.
It'd be incredible.
Yeah, I love that. A microtonal dog composer in a thruple with
yeah.
A man
that,
and a woman.
That is like, pretty fantastic.
I could probably write that, actually, and probably not get sued.
Probably not. You just change the names and set it in right. the United States in 2022, and it'll be different enough. But... Right. I just thought about that. Like, I didn't even, like, that idea when you, like, he's a microtonal composer. Yeah, like, you know, a composer who thinks, you know, below the semitone level, that would be super interesting. You know, what would music like that be like? But, of course, how would he even share it with humans since our hearing's not as good as dogs?
Yeah, well, I mean...
He'd be a misunderstood genius, and it would end in suicide. Same ending, sorry, Hans.
Yeah.
He dies. He fucking dies. So, go on.
I was going to say, I think I don't know if I can defend this, but I sort of feel like Sirius's intelligence, more than the fact that he's an intelligent dog, dooms him. There's something in the novel that that throws up the what's the word that you used, Hans, when you described the townsfolk, that
provincial.
Yeah, there's something in the novel that throws up the kind of ignorant. And it's not that provincial people are like necessarily ignorant, but they're definitely different. They're distinguished against the people of academia, and not entirely always flatteringly to the people of academia. You know, Sirius is critical of their remove from actual work, but they're distinguished in their kind of religiosity, their closed-mindedness. And it strikes me, I think, that Sirius, I think it's partly because Robert is the intermediary, or maybe that's a good a way to sort of excuse it, you know, apologia. It's hard to write from an entirely, hard if not entirely, maybe it's impossible to write from an alien perspective. But the things about Sirius that made him seem not so doggy-like made it seem like, he's persecuted for being intelligent and for being different, but really, really for being intelligent and for not being allowed to apologize for his intelligence or to conceal it. Because the only way to conceal it is to behave like a dog.
Right.
And so it felt not necessarily, I didn't entirely trust the premise that he had no place in society because he was a smart dog. A lot of the things that he was running into, a lot of the challenges, feel like challenges that anybody who is so sort of intelligent and aware of the artificiality of the different, you know, social constructs, you know, that, you know, make up society might run into, you know, like it felt like Sirius could have been, you know, a hunchback or, you know, like, or Elephant Man. And it still would have been, it still would have tracked, you know, somewhat
right.
similarly. Like he's attacked because he's smart, not because he's attacked because he's a smart dog. But the important thing there is that he's smart. And,
sure.
That's I think my take on that intelligence question.
Interesting. So one final question about Timbuktu and Sirius before we move on to next episode's pick. And that is in regards to the last podcast episode, which was Split Tooth. So I noticed in Split Tooth, like, a lot of animal imagery. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense given that Split Tooth is written by an indigenous person about indigenous issues where animals play a huge role in indigenous spirituality. Now, I don't want to say all indigenous cultures or anything like that, but I do know from just some of my past readings that Inuit and Athabascan cultures, animals do play a large part in their spirituality. So that's why, like, I thought, you know, maybe it's a loose connection, but I thought that might be interesting to talk about an animal or a novel that deals with, like, an animal protagonist. So what do we, like, thinking back to Split Tooth, how would we say, what do we learn about animals from Split Tooth versus what do we learn about animals from Timbuktu and Sirius, if we learn anything at all?
Well, I suppose in Split Tooth, there are a couple different threads, right? There are animals that are experienced as literal animals, and then there are animals that are experienced in the context of spirituality, right?
Right.
And there's actually, to my memory, most of the animal relationships with literal animals have more to do kind of with. They have more to do with the protagonist kind of either being oftentimes kind of attempting to connect or bond with animals and being unintentionally destructive, right? Like there's a scene where she feeds some kind of incorrect food to a nest of chicks and kills them all sheerly by accident, right? It's kind of a narrative of misunderstanding, whereas the animal spirits in the sections that are kind of envisioning spirituality are more. One thing we talked about when we were talking about Split Tooth last episode was the ways in which kind of it. Some of the ideas we have about, like, this is a symbol or this is quote-unquote magical realism don't neatly align onto right. indigenous understandings in general and on that book in particular. But I mean, the animal spirits, I don't think that there is a clear binary there between kind of the literal animal and the animal as a spiritual conception. And I suppose Sirius is more a question of taking a literal animal and taking a literal animal and endowing it with intelligence, whereas Timbuktu there is actually a kind of quasi spiritualism in that, right? And the way in which
right.
The way in which Mr. Bones is a literal animal but has some kind of, like, supernatural understanding beyond that of an animal. Obviously, there's no actual relationship there to indigenous spirituality, but
right.
it functions more like indigenous spirituality. So there's I think both of the works that we looked at today do different things in that regard, but they kind of both connect to different aspects of how animals function in Split Tooth.
Sure.
What
sure.
there is to be learned from that is, that's a harder one for me, right? I don't know
right,
that.
Right.
I mean, of the three, I don't think that Split Tooth has much to say about the nature of animal consciousness or animal behavior. And that's not a knock on it, right?
No,
it's just not at all what it's interested in.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
And Timbuktu, I think, is we've kind of already talked about at least what I perceive to be the sloppiness and how that's constructed, right? But I do think that of the three, it seems like Sirius was by far the most interested in really thinking in a... It seems like by far the most interested of the three in really thinking in a relatively rigorous way about the implications of adding intelligence to an animal's experience of the world, whether, right. you know, whether the results are in any sense, quote unquote, accurate or not, I think is obviously beyond verifying or understanding. But it felt intuitively edifying and kind of rich, the way that it was evoked.
Now I'm not going to say anything about any more about like indigenous spirituality because I just don't know enough. But I will also comment that, you know, the name of the novel Timbuktu stands for a thing in the novel that Willie G. Christmas and Mr. Bones believe to be real, and a type of afterlife that they call Timbuktu, which is seems to be very analogous to heaven. So there's also that spiritual component there as well. And as I said, I don't know enough about indigenous culture to know if there is anything analogous to heaven or an afterlife in any of these belief systems. But either way, you know, super interesting discussion. You know, like your reactions to Timbuktu were not what I thought they would be, but it, you know, doesn't seem to matter much when we got a pretty decent discussion out of it. So, yeah, that's
we're all
those
about
were
the
my...
content creation, baby.
I mean, in this case, I am all about the content creation. That has been an excellent aspect for me. So, Chris, your pick is up next. What do you say, my pinko comrade?
It occurred to me, actually, while we were talking about where we're having this podcast, that I could have chosen my favorite ever science fiction novel, A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Vinge, because that novel does have intelligent dog-like alien species that have very strange intelligences because they're actually like multitudinous selves. They don't have individual minds. They think together in packs.
Interesting.
It's great. It's an excellent sci-fi novel, but it is not the novel that I picked.
So I was right to call you a pinko commie. Like a bunch of people, a bunch of individuals subsumed under like a universal self.
No.
Jesus,
no,
Chris.
No. They live in a feudalist society in which the stronger pack subjugate the weaker ones. So it is far from, it is excellent. Read Fire Upon the Deep. It is truly excellent book.
I think I've heard of it. I will read it.
But that's not my pick. My pick is, I was sort of inspired by writers trying to tell stories from the perspectives of non-humans and also from layers of, I guess, like narrative, like The Dream Within a Dream or Robert telling Sirius's story.
Right.
That made me choose the author based on another work that I've read from him. But the author is Italo Calvino, and the book that I thought of was Cosmic Comics. Thank you. But I really want to read If on a Winter's Night a Traveler. I've never read it. And so It's a little bit of a tenuous connection. But that's the connection I'm making, because in Cosmic Comics, we get, you know, personified
particles,
galaxies and particles. And planets, the moon. And then If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, as I understand it, is very, very postmodernist with lots of sort of narrative play. So
I think I'm going to hate it.
You might hate this novel. But
yeah.
That's also why I chose it was because I knew that Patrick would hate it.
Yeah, this is, if On a Winter's Night, a Traveler is like the meta-est of metas, as I recall. I read it a couple years ago.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, maybe you guys, after I read it, can teach me how I should have read it. All right, listeners, that's it. You heard our discussion of Sirius by Olaf Stapledon, Timbuktu by Paul Auster, and next episode we're going to chat about Italo Calvino's If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. Thanks for listening. Peace out, comrades. Be cool.